Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. So tonight is very exciting because not only do we get to hear from a distinguished leader and hero in our community, but inside this story, we have a lot of our own organizational history wrapped up at Dallas Social Venture Partners. So I'm Stacy Caldwell, Executive Director of Dallas Social Venture Partners, and I'd like to welcome you to our inspirational evening. This is a time when we invite local business leaders to talk about philanthropy through their eyes and how they've been inspired and the mission that they have behind their own philanthropy. I want to first start out by thanking all of you for joining us this evening, and I also want to recognize Kathy Packard and Sherry Travers for working so hard with our Philanthropy Education Committee to help this happen this evening. So part of Dallas Social Venture Partners' mission is education around philanthropy and social impact. And so this is one aspect of the work we do. Many of you also know that we manage a social investment portfolio. That portfolio represents 13 different agencies within our community, nonprofits who focus on children and education. Over the 9 years that we've been together, we've invested over $1.8 million in those nonprofit agencies. And we've also provided our own pro bono consulting services representing the business expertise and the community expertise of our partners. Our partnership stands today over 100 individuals. This evening, we are podcasting the event. So what you'll hear during Q&A, we either will have a microphone available for you to speak into, or our facilitator this evening will repeat your question. And sometimes in a room this small, it feels weird, but it's important for us because as we podcast for audiences beyond our own Dallas Social Venture Partnership to the 25 other social venture partnerships out there, they'll want to hear what you're asking about. So it's my honor to introduce our facilitator today, Stan Woodward. And Stan is what we in the nonprofit world call a crossover leader. Stan comes from the corporate side of things, in fact, is from the technology world. He worked both with Yahoo and broadcast.com. He was CEO and founder of Reflect Systems, Inc., before he took the CEO position with Laying the Foundation. And here is where the Dallas Social Venture Partner story weaves into this evening. Laying the Foundation supports teachers to prepare students to excel in AP courses, sixth grade through 11th grade. And it's actually a spinoff of our very own APS, Advanced Placement Strategies, which we were early investors in, I'd like to say. And so this evening we have Stan, who will introduce our distinguished speaker, Stan Woodward. Please join me in welcoming him.
Okay, are we on? There we go. Well, before I get going with our distinguished guests, I wanted to say that the history actually goes back further. I think Mike Gelhausen actually was involved in this at some point. And the creators of this entire endeavor are sitting right here, Peter and Edith O'Donnell, right here. So it's really a pleasure to have them here. And if George Ellis was here, he'd probably take some credit for some other things, too. That's right. Our guest tonight is Tom Luce. Tom Luce is currently the Chief Executive Officer of the National Math and Science Initiative, located here in Dallas. As an attorney, Tom received his undergraduate and graduate degrees from SMU, has been honored with the SMU Law School and University Distinguished Alumni Awards. He was a founding partner and managing partner at the law firm of Hughes & Luce till his retirement from the firm in 1997. Tom was a co-founder of the National Center for Educational Accountability and served as chairman of the board from its inception until 2005. He also founded Communities Just for Kids. Is it Just for Kids or Communities Just for Kids?
Communities Just for Kids.
And served as its chairman until 2005. In 1995, Tom wrote Now or Never, How We Can Save Our Public Schools, a book that's defined his educational philosophy and outlined a preliminary plan for educational reform that called for broader support for public education. His second book, Do What Works, was published in December 2004 and received numerous positive reviews. Mr. Luce served as United States Assistant Secretary of Education and Planning and Evaluation of Policy Development from July 1st, 2005 until his resignation as of September 1st in 2006. And following his resignation from the Department of Education, Tom rejoined the board of Dell Incorporated, and he's the longest-serving outside member currently, having previously served on the Dell board from 1991 until 2005. That must have been fun.
It was.
He also served on the boards of the Texas Education Reform Caucus, multiple community and charitable organizations, served as a member of the National Commission on Teaching and America's Future, and on the Executive Committee of the Dallas Citizens Council, an organization composed of CEOs of Dallas' largest businesses. In addition, the United States Senate appointed Mr. Luce, a member of the Library of Congress Trust Fund Board, where he served until 2005. Tom also has been appointed 5 times to major posts by Texas governors, including Chief Justice Pro Tem of the Texas Supreme Court. He's perhaps best known for his role as the Chief of Staff of the Texas Select Committee of Public Education, which produced one of the first major reform efforts among public schools in 1984, and to which we still benefit today. Tom's also served on the boards or as guest lecturer at a number of schools of higher education, including the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, and SMU. And while he's very serious about education, I think he's probably the most serious at this point about his 7 grandkids, who his wife and he call the Magnificent Seven. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
And apparently has a penchant for small red sports cars. Somebody will want to ask him about that. I think this is a little known fact. I think the press has not picked up on this, but Tom actually had a little red car that he drove around when he was running for governor, and nobody thought to look there. And is it still in the garage?
No, but I have a new orange one.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to welcome Mr. Tom Luce.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I'm going to start off with a statement, and this is like a little town hall chat here, and then we'll open it up for questions after we listen to Tom talk a little bit. As Stacy was saying, it was a crossover for me. I was in the technology field. And it was easy to do because I had some people that I looked up to. You were one, obviously. I thought, you know, if I'm going to be working with people like yourself, with Peter, and some of these other people that are in the organization, you know, I can't pass that up. This is too much. Who got you into your out of Houston Luce and into your philanthropic side? Who or what did it take, and how did that start?
Well, I would say, first of all, it's a little intimidating to speak tonight because my mentors have been Edith and Peter O'Donnell since 1961, and I would say that if there was a first couple of philanthropy in the state of Texas, it's certainly the O'Donnells. And I've been fortunate enough to have known Edith and Peter since 1961. I was a mere child of 4 years old when I met them. But we've known each other a long, long time, and I was always inspired by Peter's philanthropy. The truth of the matter is I got started on education reform because of a legal client, Ross Perot, who called me in 1983 and said that he had volunteered me to be chief of staff of the Texas Select Committee on Public Education. And since he was my largest client, I had the immediate good sense to say, you know, Ross, I think that's a splendid idea. And then he further recounted that he'd told the governor that I would take a year's leave of absence from the law firm.
He overcommitted you.
Yes, he overcommitted me. And but in the midst of that first education reform bill, late one night, I had the head of the let's leave the association unnamed, but a group of administrators in public education who told me late one night, a young man, keep in mind this was 1983, said, young man, a year from now you'll be gone and we'll go back to doing what we were doing. And I resolved then to remain committed to public education, and I'm happy to report he's retired from education and I'm not.
So what were some early, when you jumped across, you got out of Houston Luce, you jumped into this, what were some of the early things that kind of happened along the way that defined maybe even now how you look at your philanthropic endeavors and how you look at the nonprofit space?
Well, first of all, Edith and Peter were supportive from the first time I formed Just for the Kids. And I would say the big moment for me, and it is really for a lot of people who want as a second career or later in life to engage in philanthropy. The big step for me was hiring somebody, because then I felt really committed. You know, I hired Brad Duggan, who had been head of the Texas Elementary School Principals Association, to help run Just for the Kids. And, you know, once you've committed something like that, it feels different than just saying, well, I'm going to help in education. Well, all of a sudden I was building a foundation and building an organization, and I knew that required a commitment to people and to an organization. And it's a big step. It felt a little scary to do that, but I would not have, just for the kids, I would not have been able to accomplish what I have in education without building institutions of great people, because as you all know from your business careers, I don't care what business we're in, it's a people business. So that was the big step for me.
When you look at Just for Kids, what was the successful outcome out of Just for Kids that may have taken you on to your next, and you know, things that you learned out of Just for Kids that maybe apply to your next venture?
Well, I took away a couple of things, and I'd like to share it, one of them in particular with this group, because I do say, in 1983, when I first started working on education reform, we had to convince people we had a problem in public education. Today, you have to convince people we have a solution. And that's a vast change that's not necessarily for the good. And I took great comfort from the fact that basically the work of Just for the Kids was to find the successful schools, grades, teachers, and subjects that were achieving phenomenal results in every state, regardless of the demographics of the student body. In other words, our task was in Iowa to find out who was doing the best job of teaching third grade reading to 100% Hispanic enrollment or 100% white, rich, spoiled kids. I mean, and I can say that we expanded to 40 states, and I can take you to any of those 40 states and show you successful schools, that public schools that achieve at a high level. Now, that to me is a very important finding, because what it ought to say to us is we need to quit debating, is this possible? It is possible. And if we're not providing that which we know how to do to every child, then it's simply a matter of public will. And unfortunately, in a democracy, you get what you deserve, and oftentimes the public will has been lacking. But it was a very important for me to see that every child can learn, and you can have successful schools in every state.
It Just for Kids, just to stay on that for a minute, when you hired Brad and then passed Brad, did you rely on Brad to bring in the rest of the folks? And how did you manage the mix of people that came in from a corporate side versus maybe the nonprofit side? How did that work?
Well, most of the people we brought in were on the nonprofit or education world, but we had a board that was filled with business people who were committed to blending the best of the for-profit world and the not-for-profit world. And as you all know, I mean, there are differences, and but I strongly believe that you have to be successful, you have to blend the two aspects. One of the things, for instance, Just for the Kids did, after it found what were the successful schools, we would send teams of people in to research their best practices. What were they doing that allowed them to achieve? And we would go to similar schools who were not achieving to see what was the difference, what was happening in the successful classrooms that weren't happening in the ones that were less successful. Well, that seems to be a pretty routine matter to a business person, but to the education world, it was like, well, gee, you can't do that. Well, yeah, you can. And it works just like it works in business. And so I tried to blend the best of both worlds.
Before we get too much off into education, which we're going to do a lot of, what other philanthropic projects can you think of that you've been involved in that were really inspiring to either others or had a big impact on your life?
Well, I would say number one, the reason that, that in addition to the administrator I told you about, that I remained so committed to public education. I've been raised by a single parent mother before there was a phrase single parent. She didn't have a college degree. She was later diagnosed as paranoid schizophrenic. I had an alcoholic father. And despite all that, my mother made sure that we lived in a duplex from the day I was born until the day I graduated from Holland Park High School. And therefore, I got a great public education. And that's why it was such a shock to me when I worked in 1983 to study the conditions of public schools in Texas. I realized, I was kind of naive. I thought every child had gotten the same opportunity that I'd gotten. And obviously, that wasn't true. And so I've always been very, very grateful for the people that touched my lives in education. I'd say the biggest disappointment I've suffered was I was chairman. Peter served on the board. I was chairman of the Texas Superconducting Super Collider. And if you all like to race some go-karts in Ellis County, we have a large road underground out there. But unfortunately, that accelerator's now operational in Switzerland and not in Ellis County. And that was a huge disappointment to me, and I think a real loss to the country. I've been very fortunate. I've gotten to do a lot of wonderful things and had a lot of opportunities presented to me by other people.
Well, let's get off into the education space because we could spend a little time on that. You talked about, kind of the teachers came up to you and kind of challenged you. What would you say has kept you so committed to education reform all these years?
Well, I just cannot conceive of any other not-for-profit endeavor that impacts more lives or impacts more issues that we're all concerned with than education. I mean, whether you're concerned about crime or welfare or economic development or, you name the issue, my mental picture is it's like the roundabouts, they call them in England, and all these roads come in. Well, all these issues come into public education. We're not going to have better health care if we don't have people that are better educated. We're not going to have technology solutions in health care if people aren't better educated. 90% of the inmates in Huntsville can't read above a third grade level. You can just go on and on. And every issue intersects with public education. And you just have to understand the numbers. I mean, we have 55 million children in the K-12 public education system. Last I looked, we had 6.5 million in private schools. 6.5 million versus 55 million. So if this country, here's the way I'd phrase it. In 1983, what prompted our commission was something called A Nation at Risk, which came out in 1983. And basically said our country was more at risk from the decline of our public education system than we were for communism. Well, in 1983, we were number one in the world in high school graduation rate and number one in the world in college graduation rate. Today, we're 14th and 15th. And the generation that follows mine will be the first generation in American history that will not be better educated than the older generation. And that has to lead to economic and cultural decline in this country if we don't fix the problem.
Go back to 1984 when you were on that select committee. What were some of the things you talked about just then, 83 in that report, but in 84, what were some of the initiatives you took down there and with Austin and some of the state initiatives?
Well, we were the first state to implement a four-year-old pre-kindergarten program. We instituted a career ladder for teachers. We tried to mandate there wouldn't be social promotion. That was promptly ignored, but at least we wrote it into law. We were the first state to have a complete assessment system, grades 3 through 8. You know, we put in higher graduation requirements. We, you know, it really was a very, very comprehensive reform package that really was the first time to really focus on assessment and accountability. And I know I can't speak to any audience who won't ask me about testing, and I'm happy to respond to testing. I would simply say, picture going to your doctor and saying, I don't feel good, and I'd like to know what's the matter, but by the way, you can't run any tests. I don't want to know what the results are. You know what? It doesn't work real well. And once in this state, we had an end-of-course algebra exam, and it was abolished in the wisdom of the legislature because 250,000 kids who took that statewide algebra test, and I can tell you it was not a difficult algebra test, did not pass the statewide test and yet had received an A or a B in education in their course. So you have to have assessment. And I also love it when people say, well, there's too much testing. Well, you know what? How many of you were not tested weekly in the school you went to? I mean, I don't know about you.
Or paddled.
But we had a test weekly. The only difference is now the public knows those test results. We're not testing kids more. I just returned from China, and our guide was apologizing for being tired one morning. He said, you know, this is a big week for my big time period for my 14-year-old because every child in China this time of year takes 3 weeks of national competitive exams to determine where they go to school next year. Okay? And we have teachers moaning about the tox test on one day. Now, we don't want to be China, but, you know, folks, we face a lot of competition in the world. And not knowing how we're doing against our international competitors is disgraceful.
Why do you think it's taken so long to, you know, measure teachers or the progress in the education system? Among all other, as you said, almost anything else you can think of or any other profession, legal or otherwise, has continuing fill-in-the-blank education. Why has it taken so long? In the education
system?
Well,
it's just, you know, it's culturally, we haven't bought into it. We still say, oh, well, you can't measure learning. Well, you know what? I get a lot of questions about, well, it's going to squeeze out appreciation for great literature. You know what? If you can't read the ABCs, you're not going to acquire a great understanding or empathy for great literature. And folks, you can test reading. You can either read or you can't read. You can either solve an algebra problem or you can't solve an algebra problem. It is not rocket science, but we don't like the consequences. We live in a society where everybody feels like they're entitled to an A or a B. And that just won't hack it anymore. When I was in Washington, I got to know the Secretary of Commerce, Carlos Gutierrez, and we talked a
Kellogg's,
lot.
Kellogg's, right? Kellogg's?
Uh-huh, yeah. Kellogg, former CEO. And I talked to him about international competitiveness, and he said, it's easy to understand. He said, we won the Cold War, capitalism prevailed, and now we have 3 billion new competitors, and we taught them how to compete. We just live in a different world. And you can't wish it away. I mean, that's the way it is. We can either compete at the high end of the wage scale or we can compete at the low end.
Talk a little bit about why we need more math and science and more kids that are adept at math and science skills.
Well, We all are concerned about the ability of helping youngsters learn how to think critically. I'm the first to say rote learning alone does not make an educated person. Well, the key to critical thinking is algebra. The math and science skills are also so important from a discipline and a rigor standpoint. But even more important, look at the economic history of our country. We have always been the innovators. Today, I don't like to talk about this, but there's not a part in a PC that's sold in this country that is designed or made in this country. We're a net importer of technology. Today, the Chinese hack into the electronic systems of the Pentagon all the time. They've demonstrated they can shoot down our satellites. They can immobilize our military. You look at the problems that everybody talks about, healthcare, global climate, energy, all these issues. They're only going to be solved with technology. And then we wonder why math and science is important. I had a wonderful career as a lawyer, but if we just produce lawyers, we're not going to be very competitive. I can tell you that for sure.
Well, China has a national, almost a national strategy, growth strategy around technology, do they not?
No, there's no doubt about it. They do. You look at the top leadership of the Communist Party in China, at least 6 to 8 levels down, they're all engineers. I can assure you there's not a lawyer in the bunch.
Yeah.
And every high school student in China is required to take physics and calculus. Not business math, physics and calculus. Now, people say to me, well, but not every child in China goes to high school. Well, that's right. But there's 1.3 billion of them, you know? Mm-hmm. They produce millions more engineers a year than we do. Well, that, you know, people, well, it's a smaller percentage. I mean, we have a greater percentage of people. Nonsense. 42% of their college graduates graduate with a STEM degree. Science, technology, engineering, or math. 42%.
So a small percent of a big number is still a big number over
it's
there.
It's still a big, well, and they have a big percentage and they have big numbers.
Yeah. So let's get it back just for right now to Texas. What's your vision of how things could change in this in Texas in this region right here? Just some ideas on how things could evolve.
I believe we're falling behind states and the rest of the country. In the 90s, we were cited by several major think tanks as it was. North Carolina and Texas were both noted as the states who had most improved their public education system. That is not true anymore. Now, let me quickly add, that was most improved. We started at a low level, but we were most improved, and that progress has not accelerated as it should. And we have to go to the next level of rigor and standards and requirements for education in this state.
Talk about some maybe public-private partnerships that you've seen work in Texas, or maybe even some charter school kind of initiatives, anything like that you want to stray into that you have any comments about?
Well, I think charter schools are great. They're a great innovation lab. But I want to challenge the people in this room to think in terms of scaling successful programs. I think a disease in our country is pilot programs. We have lit enough pilots that we should have lit a furnace, and we have not lit a furnace because we just are unwilling to stop and say, you know, the best program we know about today in teaching third graders to read is X. and therefore it must be in every school. I mean, we have to start taking things to scale. What National Math and Science Initiative is about is what I would call, to this business group, second stage financing. We do not do pilot programs. We only want to take proven programs and take them to scale. Because again, I'm all for one-on-one mentoring or a corporation helping 1,000 kids. But folks, we have 55 million in public schools. And to make a dent, we've got to take things to scale. And therefore, we need more than garage entrepreneurs. We need people that will build large equivalents of large corporations that will take things to scale.
So there's a little bit of a movement that I'm detecting to get back to some sort of a national curriculum. Every state now has their own curriculum. They've got their own learning objectives. It's just withering how many different requirements you see out there in the different states. Do you see any weight behind that movement to get back to more of a national kind of a overall curriculum?
I don't think we'll have a national standard. But, for instance, Texas should be part of a group that has states that have voluntarily joined together to have a standard algebra test in the course algebra exam. There's something like 25 states now that have adopted the same test. Well, I'm a great believer that what we need to do is set the standard. Then you can have flexibility in the classroom on how you teach to that standard. But what we need is a push for higher standards in every state. And to me it is insane that we don't have every kid take the international TIMSS and PISA test, which students in every country in the world take to benchmark themselves as to how they're doing. But we have something like a sample of 1,000 students who take that test. We ought to have every student taking that test. If you make yourself look at the results, we might have to deal with a problem we've created.
So you just got back from D.C., I understand, and met with a few people up there. Can you give us any insight on what our new administration and Arne Duncan and that bunch is thinking? Is there some good things on the way? And maybe comment on the stimulus money on the education side, what that might do?
Well, I think all you can say at this point in time is I'm hopeful, but the jury, believe me, is still out. I've met with Arne Duncan. He's an impressive guy, smart. President Obama gave a fantastic speech yesterday on math and science, the importance of our competitive position. The words are very good, but the test is going to come when those ideas are going to be tested by the unions. And I think the jury's still out, and we'll just have to wait and see. I think, as I said, I think President Obama gets it. He understands it. Arne Duncan understands it. But to accomplish what we need to, they're going to have to take on some constituencies that may make it unpleasant.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't leave with like a bag of money?
No.
To come back here with, right?
I'm just asked for the spillage.
Okay, yeah. Again, a small percent of a big number is a
small percentage. Know. I just want the crumbs.
Just the crumbs, yeah. Well, it's interesting because we keep hearing, well, it's on the way, and haven't really seen much yet, but I'm sure it's going to show up.
Well, Texas has seen several billion dollars, and right now they're planning to spend it in the same way they've always spent it. And I do know one thing. If you spend more money doing the same thing, you're going to get the same results.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Talk a bit, before we get to the question period here, when you think about, you know, people in the room, what recommendations would you have for anybody in the room that's looking to get involved either in education reform or just nonprofits that might be on the corporate side? What's some recommendations you might have for those people?
Focus. You know, you can get totally swamped by a desire to change a system of that size. So I think you've got to pick a focus for your attention. And number two, perseverance. Change does not happen. It takes a long time to turn the Queen Mary. And you have to have an attitude, if you turn it 5 degrees every year for 20 years, you'll get there. And you can't get discouraged about that, because look at Texas as if it were, the K-12 system were a corporation. First of all, it probably spends, I don't even know the current number, let's say $10 billion on K-12 education. That's a lot of revenue. They have 4 million plus customers or kids. They have 1,052 business units or school districts. They have 6,500 campuses, which are subunits. And then, to top it all off, you have roughly 400,000 employees. And you want to transform that corporation. Folks, that's a sizable challenge. And so we shouldn't be terribly surprised that we're not doing that overnight. I mean, look at the changes the telecom industry went through. I mean, look at every industry in this country. And the one huge thing they've all had to do is to change dramatically over the last 10 years, or they're not in existence today. And too often today, I read a line in a book about 20 years ago, I've never forgotten it, and this was 20 years ago. Somebody said, you know, if a doctor who had operated in the turn of the century came back, turn of the last century, folks, not this one, turn of the last century, came back and went in an operating room, he wouldn't have a clue as to what was going on. If a teacher came back, they'd recognize the classroom, the blackboard. They would notice there's little terminals on the desk, but they're not used anyway. So basically, they would recognize their work environment. And that should tell us something.
When you look out into the future, you're with NIMSI now. Any other projects that you see, either that you'd like to work on or with, or people you'd like to partner with going forward that could make a huge impact on the country?
Retirement. I'm looking forward to retirement, and I'd like to partner with my wife. No, I don't. There's nothing else I want to take on. I think I've got my hands full.
So an RV, maybe?
No.
You see that?
No, not an RV. I feel a little confined, but I'm just going to keep plugging away at what I'm doing.
Well, personally, I'm having a lot of fun. I'm a year in, I think. I think I'm about a year in. I'm having a lot of fun, and I'm enjoying working with your organization. And I want to thank you for being here. And at this point, I want to open it up for questions. From the audience, if that's good.
Don't be bashful.
We've got a traveling microphone that we'll send around. Anybody want to ask a question? When right back here. Go ahead.
I know that you've spoken about some of the programs of the National Math and Science Initiative that are not pilot programs, but I wondered if you would give the audience here, some information about some that you're particularly proud of, and you know what kind of accomplishments they've made. Some of us are familiar with advanced placement strategies because we've worked on that with DSVP, but many people here are guests and wouldn't even know.
Sure.
what that glorious story is. So if you could share some of those, that'd be wonderful.
Well, I think what Peter O'Donnell and Edith O'Donnell told me was incentives work. I think that's the phrase. And incentives do work. They've worked in advanced placement strategies. But a fundamental part of the advanced placement strategies program is really providing better professional development for our existing teacher corps. And we use incentives to get them to get the better professional development, but we have to better train our existing teacher corps. And the Advanced Placement Strategies Program, we're replicating that now in 6 other states. And our grantees had about 3 months to enroll their first cohort of students this past September. And in 1 year, in 6 states, in 67 schools, we went from an enrollment of roughly 8,000 to an enrollment of 13,000 students in 1 3-month period because of the model that Peter and Edith have constructed. Now, if you translate that into, then the data shows that if a student takes and passes one AP course, not even math and science, one AP course, graduation rate of African Americans, college graduation rate goes from 15% to 70+. Hispanics goes from 15 to 70+. And Anglo, I don't remember the exact number, it's something like 35 to 75. So, I mean, think of the number of lives, and in our 6 states, they're already committed to growing from 67 schools to 500 at the end of 5 years. So pretty soon you can see a transformed teacher core and a transformed student body. Then our second program is called UTeach, which is working on the next generation of teachers. And that's a program started at the University of Texas at Austin. It takes entering college freshmen. They enter the College of Natural Sciences or math, and they graduate in 4 years with a content degree, the same content degree any other student would receive from those colleges, and a teaching certificate. And even more importantly, their pedagogy courses, most of them are taught in the College of Natural Sciences or math or engineering. So they're actually learning, how do you teach physics? How do you teach calculus? How do you teach math? And that's training the next generation of teachers, and we've replicated that in 13 universities. And I would note we had 53 universities agree to replicate the program. We could only fund 13. So if there's anybody that's brought their checkbook, I'm happy to receive it. B.J. Gergen can take your check tonight. And I would tell you, those of you who have worked in higher education, for Cal Berkeley to agree to replicate a University of Texas at Austin program is an unnatural act.
That's heresy, yeah.
And yet they have agreed to do so because it's demonstrated the model works.
Other questions?
Tom, you talked earlier about the classroom that really hasn't changed in 100 years. You know, it was built for the industrial age, not for the age that we currently live in, whatever you want to call it. A lot of the things that are happening today in education are trying to fix the current model. You know, the classroom's still 22-1. We still have K-12, 9-month school year, campuses, et cetera. And yet today, in the world that we live in, we're a global, collaborative, fluid world where people come and go fluidly to work together. Those two models seem to be in contradiction to one another. So how do we fix what we have right now while at the same time moving into what we need to move to without wasting it all doing pilots?
Slowly. I mean, that's an honest answer, is that you have this 400,000 employees, roughly, that were trained in one methodology or one way of doing business, and you just can't transform them overnight. And so, again, most of it, though, is professional development and training. If you stop and think about it, one of the most isolated employees in the world is the teacher in the classroom. They enter the classroom, they shut the door, and maybe if they're lucky, somebody reminds them it's lunchtime. And they're without support and without help in too many instances. And I've never met a teacher that intentionally set out to mess up a youngster's life or to not teach them. But they're like a coal miner that's been mining coal for 30 years a certain way, and they only know one way of doing it. And they've got to be taught new methods, and that means you've got to have principles who are academic leaders, who will ensure that they get the right professional development. Today, the biggest wasted money in public schools is professional development. You usually have district-wide meetings, they hold a forum, and they talk about how to deal with a hyperactive child or something like that. And there's nothing wrong with them, but a teacher in the classroom in grade 3 wants to know, how can I teach a Latino student to read? And what's the methodology and how can I best do that? And we've got to focus on really better training our teachers.
Other questions?
This is not fair. Michael lived across the street from me for about 20 years and knows all my foibles. Mike?
Well, I was just going to open up by saying I can't say Tom because I grew up, he was Mr. Luce.
Right.
So we'll stick with that, Mr. Luce. You know, you've used a couple words that I think ignite some emotion, like disgraceful. You know, I've thought about this for a while myself, and until I think we are, as a nation or even as a state or a city, ignited by some passion about this being patriotic or democratic, you know, without that, to me this seems like still swimming upstream. What are your thoughts on it becoming a passion of the country? Because then, you know, our history is, when that happens, it all changes, it all improves, and it's, but I don't see it passionate right now.
I think, unfortunately, you're correct, and we've got to have leaders that have that passion. Let me give you one example, and again, I can't remember the exact number, but my best recollection is most Dallas, Ruth Fitzgibbons probably knows, most Dallas school board members are elected by getting about 2,000 votes in their district. 2,000 votes. I mean, if that's not apathy, I don't know what is. I mean, what is a more important position than a school board member? This is not true of the current board, but about 10 years ago, on the Dallas board, there wasn't a single person who had ever served on a board of any kind, nonprofit, for-profit, and had no board service. And again, I say in a democracy, you get what you deserve. And people just, you know, we are still living off of the fat of the land. We're living off of the post-World War II GI Bill generation, the Sputnik generation. And we are living off of accumulated knowledge and wealth. We are not competing with the rest of the world in the next generation. And that's just a fact. And until that registers with people, I'm very worried. And it doesn't take long. Just remember, in 1898, the parade for Queen Victoria on her 100th birthday was the apex of the British Empire, was 1898. It ruled about two-thirds of the world. World powers are not guaranteed that they will remain the world powers. And, you know, that wasn't that long ago. You can talk about the Dutch, you can talk about the Spanish. I mean, you know, we are... We better wake up, or we're just going to be a real laggard.
Other questions?
I was wondering if you had any contact with the superintendent. I think they call her Chancellor of Schools in Washington, D.C., who she comes out of your own Wendy Cox. Teach,
yeah.
Michelle Wee. I teach for America, and she's coming on quite strong, closing schools, firing principals,
right.
Turning things around. I was thinking about what you were saying about university schools of education and teaching people how to be good teachers. But I know when they get into existing school system where the teachers have been there for many years, it's, you know, they're very often their ideas are shunned and not appreciated. But she's really going in strong, and I wondered if you had any contact with her. What was your opinion? And also, you mentioned when you were in Washington, you thought that President Obama and Arne Duncan had the right point of view, but then you said there were some constituencies that might be causing some issues or blockage, and I wonder who they were. Republicans or teachers' unions or whatever. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Moose.
We'll go ahead and cut the mic off for that.
I would say in all fairness, Republicans have been obstacles to education reform, usually over issues of local control, and labor unions have been a problem to the Democrats. I mean, we had problems on the Republican side, and they got problems on the Democratic side. President Obama talks about merit pay for teachers, but he always adds the qualifier with the consent of the labor unions. Well, it's not going to happen with consent. I mean, it will have to happen by force of will. And what I try to tell teachers is, and I go speak to teachers, look, a great teacher deserves a great salary. But there's two greats there. And as long as we follow the model that she or he who lives the longest gets the most money, I can just tell you, and I tell them this, I say, you want to be treated as a professional. I was a professional. I was a lawyer. When I started practicing law in 1965, there was not a law firm in this city that did not compensate on a seniority basis. Today, there is not a law firm in the city that compensates on a seniority basis. Times have changed, and we have to, if you can't pay every teacher in Texas the same salary and ever have a teacher make enough money to support a family. It just doesn't add up. I mean, if you just add the numbers, it doesn't add up. So, you know, we have some big challenges ahead of us.
Other questions?
You all been a very tolerant and patient audience. Thank you very much.
Thank you all. And I have, thank you, Tom. John Poulter, I'd like to say a couple of closing words.
Good evening. My name is John Poulter, and I am the chair-elect of DSVP. And I'd like to personally, again, welcome everyone for attending this informative evening this night. And once again, I'd like to thank Mr. Luce and Mr. Woodward for the presentation. And as many of you partners know, Stan is not only the moderator here tonight, but he is also a partner with DSVP. So we appreciate his efforts. Very briefly, DSVP is an organization of professionals, of thought leaders, of activists, of individuals who are engaged in the space of children at risk and education. If you have any interest in really becoming engaged in our community, in the Dallas community, in the space of children at risk, I would urge you to take a look at DSVP as an opportunity. You have a packet that talks a little bit about membership, and I would encourage you to take a look at that. But what DSVP does is it is an association of terrific people, of strong people, who actively engage to build scale in the charities that are involved in Dallas. And we have selected children at risk and education as the area where we believe we can have the most impact. And as Stacy mentioned earlier, since the year 2000, we have actively invested over $1.5 million to over 15 different charities, and we have accelerated them both by means of the money that we have contributed, but equally based upon the time that we have put in. We are not simply a volunteer organization. We are involved in accelerating the growth through strategic planning, through marketing, through board governance. We attempt to use our expertise in the industry, and I have to confess, yes, I am a lawyer. That's what I do during the day. But I have had such a wonderful experience with the individuals, the partners that are in this room with DSVP. And I would welcome the opportunity to talk with any of you about becoming a partner. partnership is simple. It is an opportunity to commit for a two-year where you're investing both financial commitment and your time. The financial commitment is $5,000 a year for 2 years, plus the time that you want to commit to it. In this economy, with the needs that are out there in the child at risk space, there is no greater time, there is no greater need than what we have right now. And if you want to make an impact, this is the time to do it, and this is the organization to do it with. Again, I welcome each of you to this. I have truly enjoyed the opportunity to learn about the organization here. If you have any questions, please come up and talk to myself or any of the other DSV partners. Once again, thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Luce.